According to Pablo Picasso, who knew a thing or two about the power to surprise and challenge, the purpose of art is to wash the daily dust off of our souls. If this is true, and I believe that it is one of art's possibilities, then it's nowhere more true than in the domain of public art. Some of you may remember that a few months ago, as part of a service entitled Reverence for Beauty, Sarah asked if anyone would like to share their views on a piece of art that they enjoyed. Several people spoke about their personal favourites, whilst others added their contributions to the newsletter. My choice was The Burghers of Calais by Rodin, which is situated in the gardens adjacent to the Houses of Parliament. During the weeks that followed, several people asked me about the Burger sculpture and then discussed it with me, having made the pilgrimage for Westminster to see it for themselves. Other people spoke to me about other artworks, the public artworks that they enjoyed and admired. These included the Tower of London's Blood-Swept Lands and Seas, the Red Poppy installation, and the regular changing installation on the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square. Wendy Taylor's giant tortoises and sundial around the corner from here in Holland Park got a mention as well. And Brian reminded me of a sculpture which also features in my own personal greatest hits list, Richard Serra's Fulcrum, a 17 metre steel edifice situated behind Liverpool Street Station in Broadgate. From these conversations, it was evident that art in public spaces matter to people, and it's important for their pleasures and sense of well-being. Public art, in one form or another, has been around since the time of the pharaohs, and as in, well, I thought it was Shelley, and it turned out it was Coleridge's. mind you, I could have just as easily said Keats or Byron, really. All those Regency fellas, literary fellas, are much of a muchness. But anyway, Kubla Khan's pleasure domes, we heard about earlier. Pavilions and arenas for the use of the elite and sometimes the wider public were a feature of all major ancient civilizations. However, grand public buildings, and of course statuary, were constructed and erected mainly for its propaganda value. It was, after all, a useful way of consolidating and demonstrating prestige and power, and a good way to show off to the neighbours, in the case of the rulers of Egypt, the troublesome kingdom of Nubia next door. Thus it was for millennia afterwards. If you wanted to know what the society celebrated, look at its public squares. Here in London, the innumerable statues of heroically posed white men, equestrian or otherwise, aren't an accident. Power and wealth got to frame the discussion. The privileged and the powerful became a decorative frieze of national history because they were the ones with the means. A major example of this, and a pavilion in its design, is the Albert Memorial, which we will pass later on when we go out to see the Kensington Pavilions after today's service. However, something of a sea change happened in post-World War II Europe and America. New funding organisations sprung up and existing ones widened their remit. In Britain, this took the form of the establishment of the Arts Council and other government and non-governmental art agencies, and was further fuelled in aspiration by the introduction of the welfare state. New commissioning criteria and a move towards the democratisation of art have unsurprisingly resulted in artists, designers and architects broadening their canvas to include the marginalised, the downtrodden, as well as the rich and the powerful. And what's the best thing about public art? You can say something here if you want. It's free, yes, that's right. There are no tickets, you don't have to dress up to see it. You can view it alone or in groups. It's open to everyone and you can interact with it. As well as satisfying in terms of visual beauty, you might also find something which has soul or is stimulating to the spirit in unexplainable ways. I believe that public art is not only a simple decoration of the public space, but also reflects the human search for meaning not available through the intellect and the written word. A chance conversation with Sarah about this year's summer pavilion at the Serpentine Gallery, wherein I mentioned its cathedral-like qualities, sparked a discussion on the communal and indeed the spiritual value of public art in general, and pavilions and other temporary buildings and edifices in particular. Each year since 2000, the Serpentine Gallery has commissioned a temporary summer pavilion by a leading architect. The series presents the work of an international architect or design team who has not completed a building in England at the time of the gallery's invitation. Each pavilion is completed within 6 months, and is situated on the gallery's lawn for 3 months for the public to explore. This year's pavilion is by Danish architect Bjarke Ingels. The idea of a temporary public space with walls, and sometimes a roof, perhaps encapsulates all that is best about public art, and that embodies the spirit of openness, democracy, exchangeability, and sharing. The geographical features of the space around it and within it can be viewed in new and imaginative ways, and it's often the case it is something of a communal experience. The celebrated American sculptor and installation artist Agnes Deans picks up this theme when talking about her own work in public spaces. I like to make people feel better about themselves, and this means an awful lot to me. I make them feel good, getting above the humdrum of their daily lives, the dissatisfaction with their lives, looking for deeper elements and understandings. That is what is related to spirituality. It's not a church or a temple with a high ceiling. It's inside yourself what you find. She is convinced that an installation, or pavilion's, spiritual impact can be experienced without engaging their intellectual infrastructure. I love it that kids love my work, she says. They say that my work is so highly philosophical that it's difficult to understand. It's not true. A child of 5 or 7 can understand it and feel good, just as grown-ups can. I like to think that all good art is like that to a certain extent, even if it's not spiritual. You get into another realm. You see people searching for something when they look at a great work of art. They're looking for themselves in order to understand it. It's a fine line to walk, to create public art in the form of a summer house, for example, that operates spiritually while transcending religious or secular affiliation, all the while functioning within the dialogue of the contemporary. Of course, it would be churlish to deny that this, what are still called the great and the good, get to decide what gets built. Yes, it's those upper-class white Englishmen again. The demographic, incidentally, includes only 10% of the population. So why not give more of the commissioning decision to artists themselves and more of a voice to the wider public, especially user groups, interested parties and local residents? Whatever you do, and whoever gets to do the choosing, you can't please all the people all of the time, of course. But then again, liking, disliking, discussing, or even arguing the merits or otherwise of art is all part of the experience of looking and part of the fun. Sadly, in these times of austerity, art's regenerative potential is too often measured purely in economic terms, as if art can only be justified in the credit column of the balance sheet. This is a pretty standard practice and promotes, in my view, an impoverished, narrow interpretation of public art's pleasures and possibilities. Pleasures and possibilities. What do I mean by that? Well, a recent survey on the value of public art carried out by the City of Philadelphia in the United States found, somewhat surprisingly, that social offerings, openness and welcomeness, and importantly, the aesthetics of a place, its parks and green spaces, ranked higher than education, safety, and the local economy in terms of importance. I'm not sure the same result would emerge in a survey here, but food for thought. In London, we're spoilt with how much public art we have on display. We have the Broadgate Art Trail, the Line, which is a walk between the O2 and the Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park, where you can see sculpture by Anish Kapoor, Martin Creed, and Eduardo Pagliozzi, amongst others, and the annual Sculpture in the City Festival, not to mention the many solo sculptures, structures, and edifices in parks and squares. I hope some of you join us after the service for our excursion to the pavilions and summer houses of Kensington Gardens. When you have time, you might also like to check out the Electrofilament Pavilion, inspired by Beatles, well not the Beatles, I mean Beatles the insects, and fabricated by a robot. This striking garden pavilion is situated in the courtyard of the V&A in South Kensington and is free. In any case, my recommendation to you is to take Pablo's advice and wash off the dust of everyday life once in a while and immerse yourself in open-air art. You may feel spiritually moved, or you may not. You will definitely feel refreshed and revived.
And so, may each of us find ways to be as warm as the summer sun, touching all those we meet with kindness and compassion, helping to create our town and our world as a place of justice and love for everyone, this day and all days. Amen. Go well and blessed be.